You're listening to Critical Reads. This show is designed to help people critically analyze topics like race, culture, and faith, one resource at a time. I am your host, Neff Lesperance. Hi, everybody, and welcome to another exciting episode of Critical Reads, the podcast, as the intro says. I am your host, Neff. Thank you so much for joining me on another episode of Critical Reads. I think we are on number 13. I'm so stoked that I'm still here and that I could still make time to do this. I know sometimes I have in my head that I'm going to post one day, and as things come up and, you know, between living at home with my family and working full time, it's been crazy. I have no idea how podcasters do this for like a job, a career on a daily basis. I guess if you really love this, it might be a little easier to do. And I know some of the podcasters I listen to as well have some help, but yikes, especially being a person that sometimes deals with depression and anxiety, my hats go off to everybody who are extremely dedicated to podcasting, because it's crazy to do this on a weekly basis. But nonetheless, I'm here. And for those of you who are joining me for the first time, welcome to the show. For those who have been here rocking with me since the beginning, thank you so much for listening. I am seeing that we have quite a few listens, and so I'm really thankful for that. Even if I'm reaching like a small amount of people, the point is I'm trying to do this as a way to help people just like learn and grow. And if it's helpful for at least 10 people, I'm cool with that. Because this also gives me an opportunity to flex a little bit of my teaching muscles and get an opportunity to kind of have some academic conversations about some of these topics. And, you know, not to say that I'm a professional in anti-racism work or any of these topics that I'm, you know, talking about per se, at least I, in the sense that I don't have years and years and years of experience. But I love being able to create this space as a way for all of you, and myself included, to just be able to learn, grow, you know, create opportunities for dialogue, create opportunities to maybe stretch ourselves a little bit. And I know, especially coming up soon, there's going to be some topics that I'll talk about that will be probably a little uncomfortable for me. But again, I'm hoping that this podcast is an opportunity just for you all to see, like, it's not that hard in some ways, right? I'm going to fumble through this as well. And it's okay if you fumble through this. You know, the important thing is that we're taking steps as much as we can to like try to change and grow as much as possible. Because if we're honest with ourselves, the way this world is going so far, it's not doing too good. I mean, we're in the middle of a pandemic. I saw that there's, you know, war happening, brewing on the other side. I think all of us are seeing that. I know recently this week I saw some hints of chemical warfare. So, you know, things aren't good. So at least, again, if you're with me and you're recognizing that there's some things that need to be changed, and you're at least willing to, you know, open your mind to that and try to see what things you can learn to do that, you know, welcome. You know, welcome aboard. Let's do it together, right? So with all of that said, today's episode, we're going to be talking about a book entitled Unbound, My Story of Liberation and the Birth of the Me Too Movement. This book was written by a lovely woman named Tarana J. Burke. I'm super excited to talk about this book. It actually ended up being a really good read, even though there was a lot of parts of this book that I was like, shit, this is hard. But it was a really good read, very easy read. I think she's a terrific writer. I'm also probably a little biased because it's by a Black woman. And like I've mentioned before, I love hearing from Black women and just hearing their experiences and being able to be like, wow, I'm not alone. But, you know, regardless, even if you're not Black, I think there's a lot of things from this woman's story that is really strong and brave, and she's very captivating. And I was very touched by her willingness to just be open with us as her readers. And so I'm excited to talk about it with you guys this week. And I hope that what I share will be helpful and maybe encourage you to take a crack at this book, because it was pretty good. But before we get to that, this week, you know, as I always do, I always start off by doing a segment I like to call Musings of a Tired Black Social Worker. This is just, you know, a little bit of time where I get to kind of vent and reflect on some things that are kind of interesting or that caught my eye throughout this week. And honestly, there were a few different options, but I think one of the things that really stood out, and I've realized, okay, I might have to talk about this, is the confirmation hearing that is happening right now for Judge Ketanji Brown Jackson to be part of the Supreme Court, since she was nominated, I think, by the president to be that. And so I think there's a lot of things that was like coming up for me this week. And as much as I wanted to like avoid talking about this in some ways, because it would require me to be some level of vulnerable and have to dig deep into some feelings that I didn't necessarily want to tap into, I figured, you know, for the sake of learning and for the sake of vulnerability, I wanted to just kind of push through that and talk about it a little bit. So today, from my musings of a tired Black social worker, this is what I'm going to talk about. And so I think first thing that I was processing was just the fact of, like, unfortunately, our government is just so complex. And I think it's done like this purposefully, right? So that a lot of people don't really, you know, get involved or do not really try to challenge the status quo. I think that for me came up just because of the fact that just to figure out, okay, what does the Supreme Court do again? And who can, you know, appoint this person? How long can they stay? All this stuff. Like, I realized, like, just doing that research to figure it out, I was in a rabbit hole, because even the things that I was reading about, you know, what the Supreme Court does, why it's important, all this stuff, it was confusing to even find information about it and to really even understand the information, because it was written, a lot of it is just written in such legalese that I feel like the common man is like, what the hell? Even me who went to college, I'm like, okay, this is confusing, right? So there is that. And after I did some research and I was just learning a little bit about the Supreme Court and the fact that they're supposed to essentially be a safety net, in the sense that if something is going on local levels where an American person is charged with something and, you know, the case has such big like controversy or something and the lower levels of government can't handle it, essentially, I think it ends up going up to the Supreme Court and they deal with it, right? And again, this took a lot of reading for me to kind of figure this out. But it's crazy, like, to know that these people are, in a way, the final word for a lot of the things that go on in law. And then as I was even looking into the makeup of our current Supreme Court justices, I was noticing how, of course, a good chunk of them are white. And I think they have one Hispanic woman and one Black man that's already on here. I don't know if there's anybody else that might be half of something, but just looking at the makeup of our society or of our country, I know for me, I was processing like, man, like, it would be so nice if it was a little bit more diverse up there, right? So if we had like all the different peoples of color that are represented, like Asian, Native American, you know, people from like African descent, people from Middle East, like all these different types of people, even people that are LGBTQ, like non-binary, people that have disabilities, so that if, you know, something does have to go to the Supreme Court, everything that is covered within all the different cases, you will have different perspectives on it, different understandings of it. Because I know, I mean, all of us know that these white men, especially that are on here, their level of privilege and the things that they don't have to deal with every day, they miss a lot of stuff, right? So again, I think it will help if that space is diverse, so that everybody can be able to chip in if something is messed up. It's like, oh, wait, but did you consider this, how this person might feel, blah, blah, blah. You know what I mean? So I noticed that and I was like, ooh, okay, that's already alarming. But then it's like, if the president of the time and the senators are picking that, and again, I'm not trying to say that any political party is great, because I think both of them are racist, but like, as we've been seeing, like, Republicans right now are just showing their asses and being super racist, knowing that they're the ones that have been adding and making some of the decisions for the last few justices, I was like, ooh, okay, this is not surprising that we're here. So there's that. And then the other thing that I was kind of processing while I was looking at this was just the fact that Black women just often have to be overqualified to even just be considered for a job. And I say this because I saw that the Washington Post posted this article entitled "How Ketanji Brown Jackson's Path to the Supreme Court Differs from the Current Justices." And from here, there's kind of like a, I guess it's like a chart or an infographic where it's showing all the current Supreme Court justices, including her, who's a nominee. And you can kind of see some of the qualifications that kind of can help you be considered, even though there isn't like a set list of qualifications, according to a website that I found called supremecourt.gov that kind of explains, like, you know, what are some of the qualifications for being a justice. But basically on here, it talks about education and career. And if you look at education, they put that they went to public school, that they went to Ivy League law school. And then for their career, they consider if they were a Supreme Court clerk, a public defender, if they were part of the sentencing commission, if they're a district judge, or if they were a court of appeals judge, right? And of course, you know, for the sake of time, I'm not going to explain what each of these jobs do. Just know it's helpful to helping somebody be considered for this role, right? And so, of course, Ms. Jackson has done all seven of these different things. She has all seven of these, right? And when you look at all the other people that are in the running for this, like, at most, on average, everybody on here has maybe at least two of these things, right? Most of people here do not even reach the amount of stuff, except one person who happens to be retiring, whose last name is Breer, right? But everybody else barely have like two of these qualifications, right? And I mean, again, considering the fact that these justices don't have to have a set list of qualifications, like I said, because the website does say that the Constitution doesn't necessarily specify any qualifications. It doesn't matter like what age, your education, profession, your citizenship, it doesn't have any of that. It just kind of implies that it's important for you to have some kind of training in law, right? But again, when you look at Mrs. Jackson's qualifications and everybody else's, I was like, damn, the fact that she had to go through all these different hoops. And then on top of that, she's being questioned rudely and condescendingly by all these different people about whether or not she even fits the bill to basically have this title. It's nuts to me. And I know for me as a Black woman, I just was reflecting on that and I was like, wow, like this is so real. Like I know there's so many times me, myself, I know I'm qualified to do a lot of things. I've been published. I have two master's degrees. And there's times where I'm working under people that I'm like, you don't even have the same amount of intelligence as me, or you don't have the degrees that I do or certain things. And not to like lord it over them, but I know that they are so quick to be very condescending and just assume that I'm in the space that I'm in because of some special treatment. And it's like, no. I had to work for this. You know, I had to work hard to get here. And even then, like, people were still being condescending when I was like getting good grades, right? Because I know even when I was at Loyola, one of my experiences, I know I was telling people how I was doing like the two master's degrees together. And somebody asked me what my GPA was, and it was like a 3.8 or something like that. And the way that the lady looked at me in shock, because, oh my God, like, you're getting good grades. And I was just like, you condescending asshole. But of course, I think I was at a conference or something. I don't remember where I was, but I was like, of course, I can't be an asshole back and be like, bitch, what do you mean? Because then I look like the asshole, right? But it was just so rude that she just assumed like, oh, I'm just some dumb person and whatever, you know. So, and even then, it's like everybody has different levels of intelligence. You can't let a degree or whatever, you just determine that anyways. But I was just like, yo, don't don't do this.
So I know that was very interesting. And I will make sure I post, you know, some of the stuff on the show notes so that if you guys want to look at these articles, you can, because I just thought it was interesting. Of course, you can feel free to look beyond what I post as well and do your own research. I always encourage that. And so I think the other thing like that I noticed in this is, like, again, there was a heavy amount of like anti-blackness, misogyny. I did not appreciate how condescending a lot of these senators were toward Judge Jackson. And just to see like how she just had to kind of like take it, and she couldn't like go off on these people. She couldn't cuss them out. She couldn't be too reactive, because then, like, you know, of course, these people would be on her ass and be like, oh, look at her being this angry black woman and blah, 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 blah. You know, so I know for, again, a lot of us who are black women, we're like, damn, girl, like, we completely get it, because there are a lot of times that we get attacked at work, or we get people that are being rude to us, and we just can't do anything about it, right? And I think one of the things that I thought was interesting that the New York Times kind of posted about, and I kind of saw a little bit, is that they were pointing out how Senator Ted Cruz kind of was like, just, you know, grilling her a lot about like critical race theory. And then he kind of like insinuated at some points that she was really soft on child sexual abuse, and that she's been like coddling a bunch of criminals and pedophiles and all this stuff. And so I just thought that was really funny to hear this from the Republican Party, anybody right now, because how many times have we been looking from, like, whether it's Georgia, a race in Georgia, I don't know if it was for the Senate, but like there's a few politicians that were trying to run, and like you guys completely ignored the fact that they were like molesting little kids, that they were trying to be with underage girls. Brett Kavanaugh's dumbass was literally accused of sexually assaulting somebody, and this poor woman put herself in front of everybody to share her story. You guys all ignored that, and then you guys turn around and try to say, oh, but are you being soft on these people, Judge Jackson? Are you serious? I'm only laughing because I'm like, sometimes people just miss the absolute point, and just they're not even like aware of how stupid they are or how they sound when they say shit. And just the audacity of these claims, given that the Republican Party right now has just had no accountability for nothing. It's just crazy and wild to me. And then also, aren't you the man that your whole state was struggling and you decided to fly to Cancun and you didn't even take any responsibility for shit? So like Ted Cruz's credibility for me is like shot. So again, to like read and see like the way he was talking to Judge Jackson was just like, what the hell, you know? And I know for her, I give her like mad props, because I would have been tempted to go off on these people, and not even these poor people. I've just been tempted to go off on these people. And again, like, she, of course, there wasn't space for that while she was at this place, because I know she was being grilled by them for hours. But I do pray and hope that she at least had some space to go home and just cuss shit out. I don't know. I know she's married to a white dude, so I don't know if that was able to happen when she went home, but at least I hope with her black family, she was able to just sit there and just cuss some bitches out if she needed to, because Jesus, like, again, this was just hard to watch. But lastly, I did love the special moments that I saw between her and Senator Cory Booker. It was just beautiful to see, you know, there were some points where he was like affirming her, and just, you know, giving her a moment to kind of rest and sit and like, this, wow, you did this, you know. And he was saying how he was just so proud and happy to see that somebody that kind of looks like his mother, like his, you know, sisters and all these different things, like, were up here being kind of a representation for black folks in this current position, right? And I thought that was beautiful, especially because a lot of the times we see like black men are not always affirming Black women. And to see him like do that publicly, given the seat that both of them have, that was beautiful for me to see that. And it kind of warmed my heart considering like all the other bullshit that was happening. So yeah, I really like love that moment. And I hope that there can be space for some more of those moments, hopefully. But yeah, I mean, you know, shout out to Judge Jackson though, because girl, like you really are going through it and with these people. And I just hope that, again, you're just able to find some spaces to like self-care. And I hope that you get the position and everything else like kind of works out. But whew, I don't know if I could even do it. So hats out off to her. Hats off to her family. And I'm just really happy and proud again to see someone who looks like me being able to have a space in that kind of platform or that kind of position in this country. So yeah, that was about it, you know. And so I thank you guys all for just taking a few minutes to just listen to me rant about this hearing that was happening for Judge Jackson. And without further ado, let's dive into this book that we're doing this week. So as I stated in the intro, today's book that we're going to be covering is entitled Unbound, My Story of Liberation and the Birth of the Me Too Movement. And this book was written by Tarana J. Burke. And I'm super, super excited to dive into this book today. Like I said, because I think there's a lot of great nuggets and things that I've learned from this book that I think you guys will enjoy. But before I get into the book and the different things that are covered in this book, I'm going to do what I do and just take a minute to introduce the book by reading the blurb in the back, just so that you can kind of give a hint of what's going to be discussed. And then I will also do a quick intro to who the author is and give you so that you can have some background to why the hell is she qualified to write this book? Even though this is like kind of an autobiography, so I feel like she's very qualified to write about herself. But, you know, more so why she's qualified to talk about the subject matter. And so just a little bit about the book from the publisher. It says, from the founder and activist behind one of the largest movements of the 20th and 21st centuries, the Me Too movement, Tarana Burke debuts a powerful memoir about her own journey to saying those two simple yet indefinitely powerful words, Me Too, and how she brought empathy back to an entire generation in one of the largest cultural events in American history. Tarana didn't always have the courage to say Me Too. As a child, she reeled from her sexual assault, believing she was responsible, unable to confess to what she thought of as her own sins for fear of shattering her family, her soul split into two. One side was the bright, intellectually curious third-generation Bronxite, steeped in Black power and literature, and the other was the bad, shame-ridden girl who thought of herself as a vile rule-breaker, not as a victim. She tucked one away, hidden behind a wall of pain and anger, which seemed to work until it didn't. Tarana fought to reunite her fractured self through organizing, pursuing justice, and finding community. In her debut memoir, she shares her extensive work supporting and empowering Black and brown girls and the devastating realization that to truly help these girls, she needed to help that scared, ashamed girl still in her soul. She needed to stop running and confront what happened to her for Heaven and Diamond and the countless other young Black women for whom she cared. They gave her the courage to embrace her power, a power which in turn she shared with the entire world. Through these young Black and brown women, Tarana found that she can only offer empathy to others if we first offer it to ourselves. Unbound is the story of an inimitable woman's inner strength and perseverance, all in the pursuit of bringing healing to her community and the world around her. But it is also a story of possibility, of empathy, of power, and of the leader we all have inside ourselves. In sharing her own path towards healing and saying me too, Tarana reaches out a hand to help us all on our own journeys. So that was a little bit of the what is this book about from the publisher / author. And so from here, I'm going to read a little bit about Tarana, just so you guys can have a little bit of background of who she is, where she came from, and how she got into this work, etc. And so her bio says, a proud native of the Bronx, New York, Tarana's passion for community organizing began in the late 1980s when, as a young girl, she joined a youth leadership organization called 21st Century Youth Leadership Movement. She led and participated in initiatives around issues like police brutality, housing inequality, and economic justice across the city. That work, coupled with a desire to deepen her academic education and organizing skills, led her to Alabama State University, a historically Black institution. Her organizing and advocacy work continued throughout college and remains a pillar of her professional life. Her career took an intentional turn towards supporting survivors of sexual violence while living in Selma, Alabama, and working for 21st Century. She encouraged dozens of Black girls with stories of sexual violence, abuse, and exploitation, stories with which she personally identified. Tarana realized too many girls were trying their best to survive without access to resources, safe spaces, and support. So in 2004, she created Just Be, Inc., an organization committed to the empowerment and wellness of Black and brown girls. The Me Too movement was born shortly thereafter as an entry to healing for survivors and a mechanism for developing survivor leaders. In 2017, when Me Too as a hashtag went viral, Tarana emerged as a global leader in the evolving conversation around sexual violence. She placed a focus back on survivors and the need for survivor-centered, survivor-led solutions. Her theory of empowerment through empathy is changing the way the world thinks and talks about sexual violence, consent, and bodily autonomy. Tarana uses her platform to share the messages that healing is possible, survivors are leaders, and ending sexual violence has to be a social justice priority, which has touched and inspired millions of survivors who previously lived with the pain, shame, and trauma of their experiences in isolation. In 2018, Tarana founded Me Too International, a global nonprofit organization that serves as a container for the vision and framework for the Me Too movement. The organization serves as a convener, innovator, thought leader, and organizer across the mainstream and the grassroots to address systems that allow for the proliferation of sexual violence, specifically in Black, queer, trans, disabled, and all communities of color. So that's just a little bit of Tarana's bio, just so that you guys can kind of understand why and how she has come to this work a little bit. I know her book goes more into detail, but again, as I've shared in past episodes, I think it's always important to kind of look at the bios of some of the authors before you start reading their stuff, just so that you can kind of get an understanding of who they are, why they came to this work, and kind of get a little bit of background and understanding to like their thought process and their biases and prejudices prior to reading this book, right, or their book. And so very briefly, I'm going to talk a little bit about why I picked this book. Obviously, like I've mentioned before, this month is Women's History Month. And I think for me, you know, after I spent some time helping with recording the episode that I posted on here that was entitled Empowering Black Femmes with Chrisabelle and Rosette, during my time with them, I was listening and I was like, wow, like there's so much in this interview about what Black femmes or just women in general, just femmes in general have to deal with, that it's like, woo. I don't think we talk about this enough. And so after spending some time with them talking through the interview and all that stuff, and this was way before March even came, I was like, you know what? Not only am I going to post your guys's interview, but I want to take some time to dive into some resources that also talk about what women have to go through, right? And so, as you saw, I posted the first episode around this was Promising Young Woman, which was a movie that I did with my friend Diane on rape culture and sexual assault and how both men and women kind of contribute to it. As much as I thought that movie was well done, I also realized that it was mostly focused on a white woman and a white woman's story. So I wanted to make sure I also brought in some voices for people of color as well. And so that is partially why I chose to also do the book that I did last week, which was hashtag Not Your Princess, which centered Native American women and their voices. And so for this week, I kind of decided to go with this book because A, I think the Me Too movement has really been something that has been very freeing and liberating for people who have survived sexual assault. And I didn't really know a lot about it, except for the fact that it was a hashtag that was used by a lot of white influencers and white actresses who were coming out with what happened with Harvey Weinstein. And once I later found out that it was actually a black woman who started this movement, I was like, oh, shoot, this is something new that I learned. So, you know, given that the Me Too movement is such a big part of a lot of women feeling liberated and able to talk about these issues that have been coming up, and I know eventually even sparked the Church Too movement where people at church were even bringing up what's been happening to them behind the scenes when it comes to sexual violence, I thought it would be perfect to kind of highlight the woman that really helped start this. And also the cool thing is that my best friend Daniela ended up buying me this book for my birthday, so I feel like it was maybe designed perfectly by God, ordained by God to kind of do this book, or maybe it was just a coincidence if, for those of you who aren't spiritual. And so, yeah, so I decided what a perfect time to just go through this book, talk about it. And again, I hope it's another opportunity for you guys to kind of learn and grow from the things that I bring up. And then hopefully you read it yourselves too, and you can really get the nuggets out of this book that I feel like Miss Burke really presents. Normally with other books, I spend sometimes kind of talking about what is the general topic of the book and how the author kind of supports their arguments and what points that they make and etc. So very briefly, I will try to do that. But as you all know, the book is going to be talking a lot about sexual assault and sexual violence and surviving that and how this woman's journey from being a survivor of sexual assault led to her eventually being able to organize around creating safe spaces for women who have survived so that they can, you know, thrive and continue to live like good, productive, healthy lives moving forward after they've been through what they've been through, right? And so throughout this book, I think the ways that she just highlights her points is a lot of storytelling, a lot of anecdotes, a lot of just powerful examples of even other women, including like Oprah Winfrey and Cicely Tyson and some people that she brought up that also survived this. So it was really cool just to see firsthand experiences from this author of, you know, what has worked, what didn't work, and then even seeing how in one position, one set of things worked for that community, and then when she moved to other communities, she had to make some adjustments, but a lot of things kind of stayed very similar, and that through storytelling, she was able to see a lot of change and support and empowerment kind of happen for these girls. So that is something that we see over and over as like reoccurring themes here of how important it was for these women to be able to just share their stories and have people kind of relate to them and empathize with them and center them in their stories. And I feel like as I was reading this, this was very reminiscent for me of the work that Christabel is doing, the woman that was part of the interview of the episode that I posted on Empowering Black Femmes. A lot of Christabel's work is centered around storytelling and having the spaces that she create be led and driven by survivors. And so in the same way, I saw the same themes kind of happen with Mrs. Burke as she's sharing how she kind of overcame her own struggles, but then also how she was able to help others overcome the things that kind of happened to them. And obviously, this kind of goes without saying that I don't really think that this kind of implies that these people are completely over, oh, this happened to me, I'm over. I'm sure there's things that kind of trigger things for these survivors that they can't help, right? And also, I think sometimes even for survivors, just living with the fact that the person that abused them is still living and, you know, doing things as if they didn't do anything wrong is very difficult. But again, I think what this book is kind of highlighting is that these women are able to, with some empowerment, some encouraging, with some love, support, they are able to live lives that, you know, that they're happy with and they're proud of, and they're kicking ass, you know. And unfortunately for me, I know as I was reading this book, I was pissed every single time something came up when with sexual violence, because a lot of this, I really believe if we were just do better with teaching our men how to cherish women and how to care for women in ways that are not so toxic, we would be in a better place. But I think the thing that is hard about our society is we're not good at just, you know, trying to pursue preventative measures. We are only good at like, oh yeah, well, we'll just try to punish them or whatever, or we'll just ignore it. And obviously, I think as we continue to read stories and hear stories about people who have gone through sexual violence, silence and ignoring the problem is not working. But we just continue to pursue that route because we don't want to, we don't want to be responsible for it. I don't know if it's like, it feels like too much work, or we just don't give a shit. I don't know. But whatever the excuse is, it's not acceptable. And I know as I was reading this book, every single time I encountered like adults or people that were just not wanting to add to changing what was going on for these women, I was enraged. So anyways, let's talk a little bit about some of the things that kind of stood out to me while I was reading this book. So first and foremost, I think the one thing that stood out to me from the beginning was how she began the book by saying the following. Unkindness is a serial killer. Death in the flesh sometimes seems like a less excruciating way to succumb than the slow and steady venom unleashed by mean-spirited, cruel words and actions that poison you over time. I guess that's why I can't stand the old children's rhyme, sticks and stones may break my bones, but words will never hurt me. Every time I hear it, I think to myself, that's a lie. You can dodge a rock, but you can't unhear a word. You can't undo the intentional damage that some words have on your mind, body, and spirit. Especially a word like ugly. And so after she opens up with these words or this paragraph, she kind of goes into a story of like how growing up, there were multiple instances where people will say either behind her back or to her face that she was ugly. And of course, over time, as she kept hearing this over and over and over again, she started to believe that about herself. And so I know when I first read this, I was like, oh shit. Because for me, I know growing up, I've always struggled with like my self-esteem, and especially in the sense of like how I looked and stuff, because I don't know, growing up in like white evangelical spaces, of course, the model of beauty is usually white women who are like quiet and demure and all this bullshit. And that wasn't me, you know? And so I know, I mean, now that I've gotten locks and I feel more comfortable with my hair and I had braces for a bit and, you know, I don't hate my teeth as much. I've been a little bit more like okay with how I look, right? But for the longest, I struggled with my worth. I struggled with feeling like I was beautiful and that I deserved anything, right? And I don't think I ever had any experiences where I was blatantly called ugly like this author, but I still kind of empathize with her in that I've always struggled with seeing myself as a beautiful person, right? And so as she shared this story, obviously I related to her, but then I also, you know, wrestled with this idea of like, wow, like there's so much power in words that we don't realize, right? And she highlights this in her stories that she tells about hearing from other people that tell her that she's ugly. And then later on, as she starts opening up and sharing in her book about her different instances of sexual assault and sexual violence towards her body, slowly she starts revealing to us how she ended up basically accepting what happened to her as like, this has happened to me because I'm ugly. This has happened to me because I'm no good. This has happened to me because I'm dirty and nasty and all these different things. And I know for me, reading this from another person, my heart just like kind of broke for her. I was like, of course you're not ugly. You don't, and even if like to whoever it is, you know, you're not as like beautiful or whatever, I think that is something anyways that's kind of subjective. Everybody has their taste and whatever, right? But even the ugliest person in the world, right? They don't deserve to have their body violated. They don't deserve to have somebody take away their freedom to make a choice whether or not, you know, you can invade their body or have sex with them or whatever, right? And so that was really hard for me to read. And I know me and a close friend of mine, Diane, who's been on this podcast before, I've talked about too, how oftentimes like we will believe the worst things about ourselves. But then when you're reading somebody else say these things about themselves, you're like, oh my God, like, why would you ever say that? Why would you ever think this about yourself? You're beautiful, blah, 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 right? But on the other hand, you're thinking all these horrible things about yourself. And then to, again, for Mrs. Burke's position to have people through words and actions kind of confirm some of the things that you're feeling. Again, that was very just heartbreaking for me to have to read. And then as she goes further along in her story and just sharing about how she kept on wrestling with what happened to her, you know, going through the shame and the guilt and just feeling nasty and gross and all these different things and trying to balance like being a good girl at home and being a good girl in school and then also dealing with the shame and anger and all these things. There's a point in the story where she tells about this incident where she was doing the dishes and she was cleaning cups and all this stuff like she was taught to do. And she had like this wash rag that had like soap and water or whatever in it. And she was like wringing it out. And for whatever reason, she just had it in her mind to taste the soap. So she dared herself to try it. And she tilt her head down to kind of do that, which the taste the soap part, I was like, okay, that's weird. But she was a kid, so I was like, whatever, you know, kids are curious. I didn't really think anything of it. But as I continued reading the story, I was really just taken aback a little bit of like how her mom reacted. And so I kind of wanted to process that with you guys a little bit because this was another part that kind of stood out to me. So of this interaction, she says the following, right? Tilting my head down, I held up the rag and let a drop of the cool soapy water drip in my mouth. Then I heard my mother's voice from the kitchen door. "Tarana Janine," she roared. She always said my first and middle name when she was pissed at me. "What the hell are you doing? Are you crazy?" She flew into a rage, screaming at me. busted, I could only stammer out a very guilty nothing. I was confused by my own actions. She was probably just grossed out, but her yelling made it seem like this was a way more serious infraction. I never in all my life seen something so nasty and stupid, she kept screaming. Do you know what I used that dish rag for, Tarana Janine? Huh? Do you know? I scrubbed the gunk off the bottom of the dirty burnt pots. I killed the damn baby roach with that rag. I washed the body down the sink. That's a dirty, nasty thing you put in your mouth, little girl. As she yelled, I stood staring at her, wondering in my own small head why I had done something so gross. Is that what you are? A dirty, nasty, used-up dish rag, she seethed. Hot tears fell down my cheeks, quick and messy. Huh, she demanded. No, I stammered sheepishly. Her tone eased just a bit, like she realized this was an outsized reaction. Go in the bathroom and wash your face and brush your teeth and your tongue. I'm sure my mother thought I was crying because her yelling upset me, and it did. My mother didn't curse much, almost never, in fact, but she could reduce a grown man to tears without profanity when she was mad. It didn't take much for her to go from zero to furious, but it wasn't the yelling alone that made the tears fall. It was the confirmation of what I thought I truly was, dirty, nasty, and used up. So when I read this part of the story, a lot of different things kind of popped up for me, right? I think one, I kind of related to Tarana in that I think there's a point when you deal with trauma or you just deal with like depression really badly, you know, there's parts of your day where you just start kind of going on autopilot and you might choose to do something that you might not normally do, but you just kind of do it. And so for me, this was a reminder of there was a point in my life. I don't remember why I was so depressed, but I was a really depressed kid, partially because I feel like I was just trying to perform all the time. I was always anxious. I went to a Christian school, so there was pressures on that end. And then our family were immigrants and, you know, they weren't always like warm and loving and, you know, let's talk about shit. There wasn't that kind of family. It was very like, do well in school, don't get in trouble. And my mom, as much as she loved me, there were moments where she would just talk to me out of pocket like this lady did to Tarana. But anyways, I know there was one moment for whatever reason I was really sad and depressed and I chose to like lay in the tub. And I don't remember how I got there, why I thought it was a good idea or what. But the way that my mom like just like yelled at me and talked to me, it was very reminiscent of this incident that Tarana had with her mom. And I know as I was processing this book and again, the power of words and just how delicate Tarana's and her mom's relationship were, especially when she was little. For me, I'm like, man, like the little girl in me would have loved if my mom would have been like, you know, what's going on? Let's talk about this. And if I felt like the sense of safety to just open up to her and tell her that I was sad and tell her that things weren't okay in some ways and just have some kind of empathetic response to what's going on with me. But from very early, I knew and I had the sense that this wasn't the kind of household. It wasn't that kind of household where I can unload my burdens and feel safe and share stuff. And then on top of that, I would go out into the world and not feel safe as well, right? And again, it's not like my parents beat me or did anything too crazy. I mean, we got spankings, but it wasn't anything too crazy in that like I was being abused or anything like that. So please don't take it that way. But still, there was just this sense of like, I want to be able to share and have open dialogue with you and have you affirm and make me feel like cared for and loved by you and have even like words of affirmation and shit, right? But that wasn't really a thing in my house, right? And so I think when I was reading this book and just seeing that dynamic also play out in the story with her mom, I was triggered. I was like, oh shit, I might have to process this in therapy next time I, you know, meet with my therapist. But it was just crazy to read that. And then on top of that, to know that by this point of the story, Tarana has already experienced sexual abuse, sexual assault by two different people. And she doesn't feel safe to share any of this with her family. And then to have her mom confirm all the things that she feels about herself through the way that her mom yelled at her. It was really hard to read. And I think, you know, a lot of us millennials, and just even there are some people that are in the generation before us too that are making some of these changes. But I think a lot of us millennials especially are thinking through a lot of our upbringing and how we talk to our kids and not, you know, talking to them crazy like our parents did, and really trying to provide a sense of safety for our kids. I'm glad to see that now. But when I think about millennials and where we're at and how a lot of us are just deconstructing and just struggling with a bunch of different emotional things, I just think about, like, man, what difference would it have made if, even though the world is beating the shit out of us, especially those of us who happen to be Black and brown, the world is constantly telling us, like, you're not good enough, you're not this enough, the way you present yourself is not acceptable, your hair is gross. There's always something that's like attacking us. But it's like, man, what difference would it have made if, when you at least went home, your family can affirm you and make you feel good about yourself and just love you, right? And I know a lot of it is that our parents were also stressed out. They also have the world like beating the shit out of them and making them feel like they're not so good and not so hot. I know even with my family, my parents were always working 2 to 3 jobs. So by the time they went home, this idea of like being super empathetic and loving us in a way that just was affirming and whatever, I think that stuff is like above their radar in some ways, because they're too tired to even think. But again, it's like, what difference could that have made for us, right? And so, yeah, reading this account and just reading how her mom went off on her like this was like, oh shit, like, this was a lot to process. And that was a really hard part of the story for me, aside from reading her accounts of her being assaulted and different things and not being able to really get the help for it or feel safe enough to tell her family, like, hey, this happened to me, right? So yeah, that's like what I took away from just like the power of words. Like, it's so important for all of us to kind of think about, like, how can our words really affect other people and contribute to what they think about themselves? And I think it's so easy for us to be like, well, it's self-esteem and you need to work on it. But again, if you're constantly being reminded or constantly hearing from other people, you're not good enough, you're not smart enough, you're ugly, you're this, you're that. And especially, again, I think this happens a lot for people of color. We're constantly being told that we're not good enough, we're never going to achieve enough, we're not beautiful enough, we're, you know, you put in the blanks, right? After a while, you start believing that about yourself. You start only seeing yourself as a piece of shit that doesn't deserve anything. When in fact, like, at least from the what I believe, I think we are beautifully and wonderfully made by God. And just the fact that we exist should be enough. You know, I don't have to love you because you can play basketball. I don't have to love you because you can make me money. I don't have to love you because of X, Y, and Z. I just have to love you as a person because you're a person and you are beautifully and wonderfully made, and that's it. That's what I believe, but I know there's so many people out there that do not believe that, and so it sucks. And again, just reading her story about this part, I was just like, oh shit, this was hard. And then from here, I think another part that stood out to me, which is a continuation of, you know, the power of words, especially with the mom here, was just like the complicated relationships that kind of happen between mothers and daughters. I know by the end of the book, she does kind of talk about how her relationship with her mother kind of has changed, and it seems like they're, you know, doing well. And I don't know if it's
partially because she's an adult now and partially because like she had to let go of some things, because I know that's kind of where I'm at right now too.
But there is this incident in the book where she talks about how by her junior year of, I think, high school, she has this boyfriend that she had named Sean, and they basically were having sex. She considers this the guy that she actually loses her virginity to, because this was like the guy that it's like, I'm choosing to have sex with you out of my free will. You know, nobody's forcing me to do this and all that, which was good. I'm glad that she was able to, you know, kind of have that choice finally. But she was sharing how like they weren't really incredibly active. They were having sex here and there. I guess she was writing about this in her journal, and her mom ended up finding her journal or her diary while she was away at her aunt's house in South Carolina during the summer. And her mom didn't really respond well to that. Her mom called her aunt like extremely furiously, asking her to come home early. And when Miss Burke eventually goes back home, her mom basically made her feel like shit for having sex. She describes it as like her mom made her feel like a dirty, nasty dish rag, which, you know, kind of connected back to what happened prior. And there wasn't really much of a conversation about what happened. So when she got home without any prep or pep talk, her mom basically was like, we're going to the gynecologist now that you're having sex, like they want to check you and make sure you don't have any, you know, diseases or anything. And I think the thing that stood out to me is Tarana basically says that there was no nurturing, just shame and judgment. And she goes on to say in this chapter, we sat in the gynecologist's office at North Central Hospital in silence. When the nurse came over and told us that the doctor would see me, I stood up. My mother did not. Thinking I had misheard the nurse and moved too soon, I stepped to sit back down, but my mother snipped, she called your name, not mine. Usually when I heard my name called at the doctor's office, we went back together. Why was this different? I tried searching my mother's eyes to glean if she was being serious, but my glare was met with that familiar look, stoic, unmoving, and empty. This was her superpower, and she knew it. Go, she said, dismissing me to follow the nurse. I was clear that I was going in alone. And so from here, she describes how she kind of had to go to the back, put on a gown. And again, there's no like pep talk. There was no small talk even with the nurse when she walked back there, which was like, oh, Jesus. And so she, of course, was nervous, right? About this whole thing, right? And she goes on to say a little bit about, like, I guess the conversation that she had with the nurse as she was walking back to the exam room. And of course, it was nothing too crazy. You know, the nurse took some time to be like, hey, you know, is this your first time? She said yes. The nurse kind of tried to reassure her by telling her not to be so scared and it was just going to be a little uncomfortable. And she added at some point, like, it, you know, that it's part of being a woman, which I was like, oh God. and I will comment on that later. But I think the part of this story that kind of stood out to me is like just her experience of this and how she describes this, especially as being a survivor. And so I wanted to like read a little bit about this because I know from personal experiences, like having a pap smear was a little traumatic for me as well, but I never really thought about what this would feel like or what it feels like for people who have survived sexual assault, what pap smears and tests and stuff like this really feels like for them. And so from the book, Tarana says the following, right? She instructed me to take off everything except my bra and put on a paper robe that was folded and sitting on the edge of the exam table. She said that when I was done, I should sit at the end of the table and that the doctor would be right with me. Then she left. I did as I was told and sat on the table, waiting for whatever was about to happen next. There was a light knock on the door, and the doctor, an older, middle-aged white woman, came in and introduced herself. She told me that she would be giving me a pap smear, There was a sternness to her voice as she explained what that was and what they would be testing for. Then she gestured for me to scoot back on the exam table and put my feet in stirrups. Sweat had begun collecting on the back of my knees and was seeping into the protective paper beneath me. Reluctantly, I started to scoot back. The paper tore. The doctor didn't hide her agitation as she told me to get off the table. I awkwardly swung my body to the side and climbed down, clutching the robe close so as to not expose my butt. She pulled fresh paper down and smoothed it over the exam table. I wiped the back of my knees and got onto the table from the side to eliminate the need to scoot. After my feet were in the stirrups, she instructed me to slide down as far as I could. Now my legs were wide open. Aside from the tissue paper they called a robe, I was almost completely naked. No one had ever seen me this way, not even my boyfriend. Not in shared showers at camp, not while changing between classes or after a track meet. Never. I was careful about this. And now, for reasons I still didn't quite understand, I was basically naked in front of a strange white woman staring into my abyss. She was now taking in something I had never even seen myself. My mind was racing. I was sure that my breathing was heavy, erratic, so I tried to calm down and be quiet. I knew where to go when I was in danger of spilling too much emotion. The doctor raised her arm, showed me what was in her hand, and announced each step before performing it, but it was in no way a preparation for what followed. One of the worst things about surviving sexual violence of any kind is that for a period of time you lose the power to make decisions about your own body. Someone else takes control. Whether they physically wrestle or coerce it away, they take it. It is an indestructibly dehumanizing feeling, and for that reason, every decision I made afterward was that much more important, that much more precious. I didn't decide to go to the OBGYN that day. My mother decided I needed to go. I lay on that table, unable to voice my fears or even ask questions or pause for a beat between moments. Yes, I had been sexually active. It was my choice, and that mattered to me. I was not prepared for this. My mother didn't even bother to take 2 minutes to warn me that the doctor was going to enter me with foreign objects. I lay on the table afraid and ashamed and embarrassed and hurt as the doctor prodded me and hit me with a barrage of questions. And so from there, she does talk a little bit about how the doctor kind of had to ask her the basic questions about, like, if she's sexually active, how long, if she uses condoms, all these, you know, important questions that they usually ask, right? And then at some point, as she's asking all these questions, the author kind of talks about how randomly the doctor kind of took two fingers and just kind of jabbed it into her butt. And I guess there was some other tests that she has to do. But again, the point of sharing this story was to highlight how there was no real conversation about what the doctor was going to do, why she was going to do it. And when, you know, Tarana reacted, the doctor just ended up getting mad at her and just being like, you need to focus, you know? And she kind of said, there's no difference between this and what I've already done. And unfortunately, Tarana, just again, similar to how she had to react to the other test, the pap smear, she just kind of had to take it. And she didn't really have an option of whether or not she wanted to do this. And even though it was super uncomfortable for her, she didn't have an option to voice that it was uncomfortable, right? And so I know as I was reading this, and I was just reminded of the fact that this poor girl has described horrible instances of abuse and sexual assault and all this stuff in the previous chapter. And for her to have to experience this, I was like, damn, like, how many women have to go through this? I think a lot of the times when we have conversations about Roe versus Wade and women's health and all this stuff, like, nobody really, especially these men that are making these decisions, a lot of them don't really understand what we have to go through as women when we go to these appointments. And then I think too, to some degree, sometimes a lot of women are so desensitized to the pain of this, or like not being heard or not really talking about this and all this stuff, that they sometimes are complete assholes when they're being our gynos. Because I know even in my own experience, like my first gynecologist visit, which sadly or not sadly, I don't know how people will look at this, but it was when I was 27, because my family doesn't talk about this stuff. And at some point I was like, I'm an adult now. I probably should be doing this, even though I'm not sexually active. But when I went, there was no conversation, obviously, with my mom about this, because my family doesn't really do this. Luckily, I had some friends that I feel comfortable enough to kind of talk to me about some of this. So I was able to ask a few questions here and there. But nothing in the world prepared me for the experience of getting a pap smear. And I know, like, the lady that I did have, the white woman that was a nurse practitioner, actually was pretty nice. But still, like, nothing, no niceness can really prepare you for the shit that you have to deal with. And then I had like an Asian woman that was my nurse. And like, again, I think because there's this sense of like, we all of us women just have to deal with this, so you need to get over it. She was an asshole to me about stuff. And I know for me, as a person that has had nobody, you know, I haven't had sex, so I've had nothing down there. There was a lot of fears that I had to have like a foreign object in my body. I didn't know what to expect. It was actually for me very painful. So the fact that the doctor rather was just not very understanding, and she was an ass throughout the whole process, like, it made the procedure very traumatizing for me. I remember when I left the procedure, I went back to Loyola, and I was, you know, meeting with friends at the library because we had to study and do some other stuff. And I was pissed all the way there. I was even to them like, where's my pussy hat? I need to go in March. Like, what the hell? Like, because I never knew how bad it was. And unfortunately, because as women, we don't even talk to each other about this stuff. Like, we're just like, oh, it's just a normal part of being a woman. Like the stuff like they told this girl. There was no prep. There was no, you know, kindness about it in some ways, even too, with the doctor, who even again was happened to be a woman. So that was crazy to me. So again, as I was reading Tarana's story and just thinking about, wow, like already a lot of her autonomy and stuff was taken from her from her first few sexual experiences. And then to go from that to now you're being asked to go to this facility or to this doctor to do a pap smear, to have no kind of like prep beforehand, to have no conversation with your mom about what it's going to be like, to have no one really holding your hand and comforting you through this process. And I know her mom didn't know, but it's like, still, I imagine if I had a kid, like, I would want to prep them for some of this stuff. I would want to talk to them. I would want them to feel safe. Even if they were having sex and I was like, you know, I don't know if this is something that you're ready to be doing as a teenager, I would still make sure that we're having these conversations, because unfortunately, shit kind of happens, right? And for us to take this route of not talking about it is more helpful than, you know, talking about it. I will never understand that, because whether you talk about it or you don't, people are going to make decisions about their sexuality and having sex and all that stuff. So I will never understand this position that we have as a society where we're like, oh, well, if we don't talk about it, it's not happening. It's like, what? Are you serious? And so, yeah, it was hard for me to read that and to see what this poor woman went through. And then even after the appointment, her mom was like still like very cold, stoic. And when she told her mom even about the thing that happened with her butt exam, her mom just kind of like laughed. And I thought, you know, as I was reading it, okay, maybe this moment of laughter will open up conversation between her and her mom and they can talk things out. No, her mom, like, continued to not talk about stuff with her. And even later on, Tarana talks about how her mom eventually was talking about what happened to her I think a family member or an aunt or somebody else, instead of like talking stuff out with Tarana. And so again, I think one of the hardest things about this book, besides reading the stories of Tarana's sexual abuse, is just, again, seeing the dynamics between her and her mother, and kind of seeing how a lot of it was similar to the dynamics between me and my mom, and how, I don't know, there's like this longing that me and Tarana both had of like, man, like we really wanted to be able to talk with our mother about these hard topics and express things that are going on and feel the sense of safety and support and like, you know, emotionally, not just the financial bullshit, right? But that part was like missing. And I know when I look at Tarana's story, I'm like, man, like how much different could a lot of her stuff have been if she did have that sense of like, I can talk to my mom about anything. She will be here to support me emotionally when I need it, right? And very similar to me too. I'm like, man, I feel like little Neff would have benefited so much more from a mom that was empathetic and willing to talk things out, instead of like a mom that's like, you know, closed off and doesn't really emotionally let herself, I guess, let me in. And so, yeah, it was very hard to read and process this. And then again, to see how, like, she just kind of threw her into this doctor's appointment, didn't really talk to her about it, was cackling about stuff that didn't need to be cackled about, and just basically led with, like, shame, anger, and all these different things. And again, like, at least for me, I feel like our society already makes Black women, Black people in general, just feel so shitty about ourselves. So when I see Black families kind of continue to say all these shitty things to their kids and continue to make their kids also feel like shit, it's like, where is our safety net now? Like, if we can't have a safety net at home and we can't have a safety net in society, what is our place to call home? What is our safety net, right? And fortunately, there are a lot of people that are eventually able to create that with other people, and they can build their own communities and their own families. I feel like Tarana, at some point of her story, she did have that opportunity to build like another like family through her organizing work, and have people that mentored and supported her and saw the best in her and encouraged her and stuff like that. But again, it's like, what difference could it have made if you kind of had a shot at that at home too, you know? And that's not to say, like, I think she did share some stories about like some family members here and there that did kind of encourage her and help her in some way. I think even like her grandpa, for example, he really got her into like reading and learning about, you know, Black power and empowering her in some way. So there were a few remnants of that, which was good. But again, what difference could it have made, especially when we think about the mother-daughter dynamic? And whew, again, this book really brought out a lot of feels for me on that. And then lastly, I think a hard part of this book was to read about this guy that she talks about. His name is Reverend James Luther Bevel. And so the way that she describes him in here is that Reverend James was a giant of the civil rights movement. He was one of Dr. King's like chief strategists and lieutenants, and he was the architect of some of the boldest, most historic events of the movement, including the Birmingham Children's Crusade and the Selma to Montgomery March. But then Tarana goes on to say that he was also a serial child molester. Yikes. And so as I was reading about this guy Bevel in this book, I was extremely disgusted because of the fact that throughout this book, Tarana basically describes several instances where people in the community of Selma were noticing that this man was being super inappropriate with children, and they were making active decisions to just ignore all of his stuff, ignore everything that he was doing. Even when at some point of this book where she shares about the fact that somebody wrote a letter saying like, this is what this man has been doing to my kids, a lot of the prominent figures of the community knew about this and they were just silent. they were just kind of creating spaces to still protect this man and giving him access to spaces where there's going to be children and just exposing him to all these different kids. And so I think as I was reading this, I was just saddened by the fact that this is such a, I guess, like popular thing that happens in a lot of our communities, but also like especially in the Black community, because I know just processing Bevel and thinking about people like R. Kelly and Bill Cosby and all this stuff. And it's like, I know sometimes we're like grasping at straws to have good representation in the Black community that we can all be proud of, that we can look up to and blah, 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 blah. But to me, I'm like, things will never be so desperate that we need to start ignoring sexual assault, you know, pedophilia, molestation, and all these different things, so that we can have those people, right? I think there's a lot of great men out there, a lot of great Black men out there that don't get the spotlight that we could easily find and give them the spotlight before we give these assholes spotlights, right? And I think it was hard because I know like I was looking at this guy's Wikipedia a little bit and looking at some of the other resources about him through Google searching and stuff. And yeah, I can see how he got away with a lot of this stuff, because when you look at his bio and all the things that he's accomplished, I know the Crusades were one that I brought up, the Birmingham Children's Crusade. He also was part of the 1965 Selma voting rights movement. He also did some other like really big things. And it's like, okay, it's hard to like, you know, see a man who's like building up the community in such a way, but then also like reconcile the fact that it's like, this bitch is disgusting. Like, he's molesting children. Like, you know, it's hard to sit with both of these things. But at the same time, I'm like, again, we do not need to be so desperate for strong Black men that we're uplifting these monsters. I'm sorry. Like, R. Kelly's music will never be that good. Bill Cosby's shows and whatever else he's done for entertainment will never be that good. Whatever this man did will never be that good. Like, we need to hold these men accountable. And I think it's hard as a Black woman when I'm reading stories about men like this. And it's like a good chunk of organizing and a good chunk of like these protests, even like a lot of that stuff doesn't happen without our work. Like, you know, if you look at the biggest movement, even the civil rights movement, yes, there were a lot of these men who ended up being the faces of it. But a lot of the people that were playing a role of like making sure people were at places, that food was provided, that rides were provided, like all the other big things that needed to happen, a good chunk of that was the women. Like, we don't get the credit for that a lot of the times. It's always like, oh, look what Martin Luther King did, or look what Bevel did, or look what blah 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 did. But nobody talks about the hard work that it took for this stuff to happen, you know, through the backs of Black women. I mean, even today you are seeing with the Black Lives Matter movement, a big part of the work that has gone into that has been Black women. Like, there is some Black men out here that are doing some of the work, but a good chunk of the leaders, the good chunk of the people that are really trying to speak truth to power are the Black women. And so, I know, like, when I was reading this stuff and reading about Bevel and what he was doing to those kids, and the fact that so many people knew, including like the mentors of Tarana, like some of her mentors were part of supporting this man and like, you know, turning a blind eye to this. I was just shook. I was disgusted. I know I felt really bad for Tarana too, because it's like, man, I couldn't imagine like some of my closest friends, you know, me finding out that they are like aiding and abetting like some serial child molester or a serial rapist. And they have no qualms about that, and they have no remorse about it either. And I know there were points of Tarana's story where she tried to call people out. Eventually, she wanted to leave. And one of the people that supported her the most and was a senator that was supporting Bevel, that lady ended up retaliating against her. And I was like, really? Like, this is the move we're going to do right now? Like, really? And so that was disappointing. But I think, it goes to show, like, a lot of the time we get mad at men for this shit. And it's fair because they're the ones that, you know, aid and abet each other when they're, you know, doing this shit. But it's also like women are a part sometimes of creating these structures and reinforcing these structures and not challenging them, right? Because I even think about like some of the patients that I've had, and particularly I have a patient right now that she's a Black woman in her 40s, and she has told me about multiple instances of like sexual abuse, and even her mother playing a role in like, you know, having her be abused, in that, like, you know, some of her boyfriends and stuff have abused her, or that she's used her daughter to kind of pimp her out to get drugs. And the women in her family have basically stood by the mom and be like, well, you need to forgive her. And it's like, are you guys fucking kidding me? Like, she tells me this story and I'm mad, you know? I'm like, are you fucking kidding me? And then outside of my patient, I think it's also very sad and alarming that I've heard countless times again and again and again and again, people are saying things about how they will have family members that are like, oh, you know, make sure you change your clothes when your uncle comes home or to visit, or don't be so fast or whatever. Like, they make all these different excuses and ways to like blame the victims of incest or the victims of sexual assault, sexual violence. But there's no accountability that a 30-year-old man, or, you know, some grown-ass man is like looking at these little kids like they're sexual objects. I even think myself, I'm like, I'm in my 30s. Even dating somebody that's like 18, 19, 20 is like weird for me. And technically they're adults. And I'm saying like 18, like they're out of high school and they're in college. I'm like, that's weird. So I can't even imagine what would draw somebody to be attracted to anything under 18, even 18, like at my age, unless I'm 18 and I'm attracted to an 18, I'm like, this is weird. So the fact that we're not checking these men or checking these pedophiles, because I know women do this shit too. The fact that we're not checking the pedophiles and we're trying to make excuses for, oh, this person's acting older than their age and shit. It's like, what is wrong with our society? I can't. And so, yeah, this, I think reading about Bevel, thinking about people like R. Kelly and Cosby and all this stuff, it makes me sad. Because again, I know as Black women, we work so hard to try to uplift our community and do better for our community. But then to have these Black men like just completely dishonor our body and practice misogynoir and not think about the impact of this and blame us for this shit, it's like, wow. And I know even in reading Tarana's story, there were so many things that like stood out to me, especially the fact that like these little boys that did things to her, because I know she was a teenager too, but the fact that these little boys like learn this stuff, that they can violate somebody and even blackmail them into being violated. Because I know one of the boys that did things to her, like, he basically was using Polaroids as like blackmail, like, oh, I'll put out your pictures if you don't do this. It's like, we need to think hard about how we're teaching men to behave, and how the fact that we're teaching them this stuff so early, and how this is just like generationally just happening over and over in our communities, and we're not trying to do anything about it. Instead, we're blaming the wrong people. We're holding accountable the wrong people. And yeah, it's just rough. And so just to end, when I think about how this book has kind of like challenged me or forced me to think about things differently, you know, in light of like conversations around Me Too and sexual violence and all this stuff, I think just kind of similar to what I was saying about the Bevel stuff, it's so important for us to not like shame or blame victims. I think that's something that continually was like coming up for me. And I think when I was reading this book, the thing that really like hit the point home for me is when she talks about how she was doing some work in an after school program where she was trying to kind of do community action through arts and culture. And so as she was developing projects, dances, plays, and other forms of creative expression to kind of help these young people find new ways to express themselves and feel empowered, etc., she started to notice like a lot of this stuff was not really addressing sexual abuse or sexual assault and exploitation. And so, you know, she really then kind of highlights like, okay, these are the things we were seeing, right? And there's a lot of different stories that she brings up that I was like, oh my God, I can't believe this happens all the time. But one of the paragraphs that stood out to me is when she says the following. She says, "We were dealing with two middle school girls who were gang raped, one of whom tried to commit suicide as a result, and another who got pregnant at 14 and was made to keep a baby as punishment for opening her legs. We were dealing with a girl who was in the children's home, a local foster care program, with the baby she had by her mom's boyfriend and pregnant with the child of another abuser. We were dealing with a girl who was 16 and pregnant by a 35-year-old married man. Her mother refused to press charges because who's going to pay for that baby? And we were dealing with an administrator at the local high school who we had come to find out was allowing girls to get out of detention or other trouble if they went to his office and gave him a lap dance, or as in the case of the dance team member in our program, performed her dance routine privately for him while in uniform." And I'm not laughing at this because I think this is okay behavior. I'm laughing at this because I'm like, how in the world can adult people, you know, come together and say shit like, oh, well, this is punishment for you opening your legs. That one was one that I was like, what? Like a 14-year-old was gang raped and this was the best response that you could have given? Like, are you serious? Like, I just don't get it. And then even, again, the other story of, like, somebody being in foster care and, like, she is being forced to have a baby that was a result of her mother's boyfriend doing something to her. Or this other story where this 35-year-old is, you know, preying on this 16-year-old girl and she becomes pregnant and her mother's response is, who's going to pay for this baby? It's like, what? Like, this is the best that we can offer these young children? And don't even get me started on this administrator that she brings up too. Like, for me, I'm like, not only do these men belong under the jail, but the people that are, again, seeing this stuff happen to these women and are making excuses for them and accusing these women, or sorry, these little girls, they're not even women, these little children of being responsible for what happens to them. It's disgusting. And I know a lot of it, unfortunately, is probably a trauma response for some of these women because they probably had to go through it in the past and nobody, like, affirm their shit, so they're like continuing to do it to others. But I just am like, we need to do better for our children. Like, this is unacceptable. And especially, I know as Black children, a lot of the times people see them and they're like, oh, well, they're just really developed and this is how they are. And it's like kind of seen as like they deserve this behavior. And it's like, no, like, there is never an excuse for this. And it's not just with Black kids or Black femmes, Black boys. There's never an excuse for anybody to violate them in this way. It's disgusting. And I think in saying that, another thing that kind of came up for me was just like the importance of accountability. Because I do think a lot of the times, like, we fail to do that because I think part of it is like we might be afraid of like, how will this look if members of the Black community have to call other members of Black community out, right? I think Tarana brings this up a little bit too. And when she says the following, she says, Black people are always carrying a sense of responsibility for uplifting the good name of our people because we are so used to others reducing our humanity and worth. While we absolutely have to name and work to eradicate the violence that Black people, particularly women and femme-presenting folks, experience at the hands of white men, specifically law enforcement, both in and out of incarceration, we also have to name and work towards solutions that will interrupt the violence we experience at the hands of our own partners, pastors, uncles, cousins, classmates, teachers, coaches, and others. Black men don't have to be excoriated in that process, but they do have to be prepared to listen, understand, and in some instances embrace accountability for the harm they have caused or make space for Black women and femmes. And because we have all been raised and socialized in patriarchy, many Black women have to do the same thing. Nothing about my work or life is about not loving Black men. Indeed, I don't believe you can practice love and be in community with folks without an incorporation of accountability as an ethic and a practice. And I wanted to read this because I think this is such an important part of this conversation. I think a lot, especially lately, as I've been seeing in these social media streets, whenever you ask, especially Black men, to be accountable for their violence towards women, their self-hate or their misogynoir towards, you know, Black women, it's this thing of like, oh, well, you guys just don't appreciate Black men, you don't treat us as kings and blah 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 blah. But again, it's like, we can love you and care for you and treat you as kings, but, you know, part of that is also recognizing that love means accountability. Love means calling you out when you're doing something wrong. Which is vice versa. Like, if we're doing something wrong too, like, love means you have to call it out and say, hey, this is what you're doing that's wrong. This is what you're doing that's hurting me. How can we reconcile this, right? And I think we miss that a lot in a lot of the conversations we have about Blackness and unity and, like, repairing the Black community in general. And I do think, unfortunately, for Black men, it kind of happens because they're so concerned with being close to, like, white power and white wealth and just proximity to white men that they'll stop at nothing sometimes to kind of bring us down and, you know, practice their BS patriarchy stuff and reduce us and objectify us to, like, nothing. So I do like that she's saying that it's not that we don't love you. It's like, loving you means that we have to call you to accountability. And I know for me, I think it's rough to go from reading stories about, like, oh man, like, look at how these white men used to rape Black women and basically use their bodies as they were nothing and, you know, rip them away from their partners, you know, during the slave times and all this stuff. And then now we're, like, looking at our community and it's like, you Black men are literally doing what these white people used to do to us, you know? And again, I know that sexual assault and everything, it's not really relegated to just specific races. I think all races have struggled with this because, unfortunately, the way that we look at womanhood is just horrible, and, you know, we're kind of relegated to, like, an object that men can use however they please. So I'm not saying that this means that Black men are the only rapists or anything like that. I think every single culture has rapists in it. I mean, even with white people, how many documentaries are there about y'all, like, doing this at this point? Like, CC, Ted Bundy, and some of these other horrible people, right? So it's not to say that there's anything specific to Black men that's like, oh, well, look at them, you see, they're rapists. No, but I'm saying that, what about we imagine a world where we don't have to do this to our Black girls, we don't have to do this to Black women, that, you know, part of us uplifting our community also means you cherishing us and not just treating us like property. Because I do think, like, if we as Black people actually treated each other better and that we create these safety nets for each other, we could see a lot more happen, you know? And I think it's kind of similar to what I was saying about the dynamic of moms and daughters. Like, if we actually, you know, created safety nets for each other and loved each other, encouraged each other, affirmed each other, not spend so much time tearing each other down, like, we could see way more happen than what we're seeing now, you know? And I think a lot of times, because a lot of us can get caught up into like trying to have proximity to whiteness, we kind of do what they do in that we start objectifying each other. We see each other as a commodity, as a means to an end. Like, we used people. And I think for me, reading this book was just another challenge to that, especially given the fact that I am somebody that I can consider myself in a place of privilege. I mean, I happen to be a Christian. I'm heterosexual. I am upper middle class, technically. I have had access to education and a lot of resources. So for me, it's a constant challenge, even for myself. Like, I need to hold myself accountable. I also need to allow people to hold me accountable. And I also need to learn how to not let my proximity to whiteness stop me from being a good person, stop me from empowering other people, stop me from wanting to challenge systems. And I do think that is something that we need to continue to build up in our community, Black people, because if we don't do that, we're kind of destroying ourselves from within as well. And I think, unfortunately, a repercussion of that or result of us working so hard to being in proximity to whiteness sometimes is that we let things like this slide, where it's like all these poor little girls are being objectified and molested and used and abused and all that stuff, and we're just like, okay, that's none of my business, you know, and it needs to be our business. And last but not least, I think this book also just kind of highlighted for me the importance of just having honest conversations about like sex, sexuality, sexual abuse, and all these different things in the Black community. Because I think about my own journey, and I mean, I was fortunate that I didn't encounter anything in terms of sexual abuse, but I know I've been like objectified, and people have, like, men, older men especially, when I was a teenager, would say stuff that I'm like, ew, like, I'm 16, you know. But just hearing from Tarana's story, how many women that she's encountered that had similar things, like, this person touched me, this person did this, this person did that, and just seeing how many of these children didn't really have the possibility of like, let's have this conversation in my family, I'm like, man, like, I wonder how much of a difference this could have done for them, right? And I will say I really appreciated that part of Tarana's story is that she has a daughter. I don't know if she happens to be in the LGBTQ community, because I did hear her use they, them pronouns. So I apologize if, you know, I mispronounced you, because I'm not sure. But they was basically saying to her to their mother that they had some experience with the boy that basically led to her being sexually assaulted and everything. And I love that for Tarana, because she recognized what she went through and how she didn't feel like she had a safe space to share things. Tarana ended up telling Kai, her daughter, like, okay, you can go and write this down on a piece of paper, like, you know, I kind of do with my kids when I'm asking them to share things in her organization. She's like, you can go write this down and share this with me whenever you're ready. And Kai eventually felt comfortable to write this down. And when she did, her mom didn't hit her with like shame, guilt, you know, any of these horrible things. Tarana actually looked at from within, from like her experiences, and she was like warm and pathetic. She talked to her daughter and they were able to have something beautiful come out of this. And it was unfortunate that Kai also experienced sexual assault. But I love that Tarana didn't let this be another example of like how not to do this. She took it as an opportunity to really love her daughter, affirm her daughter, and be there for her in a way that she didn't receive when she was a kid. And, you know, I think, again, this is another example of like, man, I wonder how different we all would be if we did have those kind of relationship with our kids, you know, or if we experienced that kind of relationship with our moms. And so I was really encouraged by that. And I, again, hated that this happened to Kai. I hated that this happens to a lot of other girls. But it was, again, another opportunity where I was like, okay, even though this did happen, I'm glad to see that Tarana was able to just really be there for her daughter in a way that most daughters don't experience, right? And so, yeah, I really do encourage you guys all to read this book. I know for me, it really helped me understand the Me Too movement a little bit more. It really helped me understand a little bit more about the experiences of those who have experienced sexual assault and have survived. And it's also helping me really continue my work of like reframing how I talk about this stuff, reframing how I respond to this stuff. And also helping me with like just doing more to build awareness around this. And with that said, I know at the start of this episode, I brought up sharing resources around the Supreme Court and the confirmation hearings and the process and, you know, some of the articles about what's going on with Judge Jackson. But I also wanted to note that I will also be adding some resources for the Me Too movement, because as I was doing some research on Tarana Burke and, you know, all the things that she has going on, I found out that they do have a organization or a website called MeTooMovement.org, where a lot of people are, you know, sharing about their experiences. They have a lot of resources for people who have survived sexual assault. And, you know, for those of you out there that stuff has happened to you, I just want to make sure I post this as a resource. I mean, there's a lot of resources out there, I imagine. So, you know, if there's something else that works for you, don't feel that you have to be pressured. But I did find that this could be also something that is helpful for, again, those of you who have survived and, you know, just having people that can understand you and understand what you've gone through. So feel free to check out the site, show them some love, learn what you need to learn, or, you know, get the help that you need. If it is therapy, if it is just finding a support group, whatever it is that you need to facilitate your healing, don't be afraid to do that. Don't be afraid to fight against family pressure or, you know, maybe bad advice from people that don't know what the hell that they're talking about. And seek the help that you need. Seek the help that makes sense for you. And again, just know that whatever happened to you does not define you, and you're not the problem. It's the system that's the problem. It's rape culture that's the problem. It's that man or that woman or whoever it was that hurt you. That was a problem. It's not you. And I hope that for those of you who have survived sexual assault, that you are able to eventually find a place of healing, a place of rest, good support, and that you are able to move forward and feel confident in yourself and empowered to take on the world again. But, you know, of course, take your time. I know there's no quick fix to this stuff. And I hope that maybe even picking up a book like this and reading about somebody else that has gone through this can also be encouraging for you as well. And so I know this is a really hard topic, so I appreciate all of you who listened to this podcast episode. I hope you were able to learn some things. I know I didn't focus a lot on the actual event that happened to this author, and there's some things that I didn't talk about, and I just want you to know that was done intentionally, because I do want you to read this book, because it was a hell of a book. But I hope that what I did share and talk about and process was also something that was able to help you just like learn and think through some of this stuff and deconstruct some of the crap that we kind of believe in, right? And so with that said, I thank you guys so much for tuning into another episode of this podcast, and I hope that you will be back next week to listen to the next episode. And in the meantime, please enjoy my outro. Hey there, and thank you for joining me on this week's episode of Critical Reads. To find out more about me or to consume more of my content, please feel free to visit my website, soulsessionswithneff.com, where I share a variety of things, including blog posts, resource lists, and have a regularly updated calendar for this podcast. You can also follow me on Instagram and Facebook using the handle @soulsessionswithneff. While you're at it, if you really enjoy listening to Critical Reads, I encourage you to please subscribe to this show on iTunes, Google, or Spotify, and take some time to rate us on these different platforms. Your reviews will really help the show gain some visibility and also give me some much needed feedback on how the show is doing. I thank you in advance for your time and your support. And until next time, this has been Neff with some Critical Reads.